overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change, to create a brand new life. I am.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center of Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
So good morning. And welcome to the Center for Spiritual Living. This is the last Sunday in February. And this month we're speaking about love and the meaning of life. And in particular, this Sunday, we're speaking about meaning and the song of the soul. And so I invite you to enter into that spacious place within you where we discover what the meaning is of this beautiful life that we've been given. Now, it's interesting when you undress the idea of meaning, we realize that the egoic mind has a purpose, perhaps, has a plan, a goal, but the soul doesn't. The soul seeks meaning in the simplest of things. My neighbors are here today, and they rescued a little squirrel that had fallen out of the nest. And in that rescuing, the question is, did they rescue the little squirrel, or did the little squirrel rescue them? When we realize that we're all in this dance together, and we find meaning in the simplest of things, like tending to one of life's fragile children, even, albeit not a human child, we then find ourselves as the Divine Mother. I noticed this week in Texas, after the very cold spell hit, so many good Texans were out there rescuing the sea turtles. Hundreds and hundreds of sea turtles. They were keeping warm enough so that they could then release them into the wild. And as they lovingly let those sea turtles back into the ocean, I could feel that this was meaningful for them, because they weren't separate. So what if the invitation is to find this connection in this beautiful thing called life, where we're not separate from one another? And then, as my beautiful Terry Hartman says, I'm dangerously free now. Dangerously free in a soul that is no longer bound by the cage of the past, the cage of belief systems, the cage of futurizing. And then we come home to the sacred moment, which is always there. A moment that is rich with possibility, a moment that is rich with intimacy. And then we can become intimate with even the smallest of things. I see the neighbors with their little baby squirrel. I never got to meet that little squirrel, but I noticed when they were telling me about this little creature, how they were both expanded so much in tending to this little fellow. So this Sunday, we're going to enter into that field of love together, knowing that love is a gift. It has already been given to each one of us. And it says in the book of John, God is love. And so when we are loving, we are being godlike. It was Meister Eckhart that said, we are here to be the mother of God. Such a radical statement from a mystic in the 13th century. To be the mother of God. We are here to give birth to our own divinity. The one life, the one love, the one power, the one presence through our own very life form. So I invite you to ponder the imponderable this Sunday, to rest in the awakened presence that lies within you. To listen deeply to that still small voice that Eckhart Tolle says does not get louder, but gets clearer when we become still. we hear the bird outside singing. And there is a saying, the bird doesn't sing because it has a message. The bird sings because she has a song. So could we discover the song of our own soul, our jubilant and beholden soul? A song that wants to be sung from the heart of hearts within us. The four-leggeds know about that song. My little cat, she would purr her song. My little pug, he will snort his song. My old boy, Bert, well, he shakes his collar and he looks at me with his big sad eyes and he lets me know what he wants. And I say, yeah, I am here for you. It says in the Hadith, I was a hidden treasure and I longed to be known. So I created the world. I was a hidden treasure. This is the divine presence. And I longed to be known. So I created the world. And so we are the creation of this hidden treasure, this hidden wholeness, this divine presence, this awakened love. And it longs to be known. And so by saying yes to that, we create an opening, a passageway for the transmission of that which we all share. It is so vast, so intimate, that the mind can't grasp it. And so throughout this whole month of February, we've been placing our head in our heart. The Sufis call it the cave of the heart. And Ram Dass says, imagine that you are sitting in the cave of the heart and you are tending the embers of the fire of love. And we're all sitting in the cave of the heart together, fanning that ember of love, that fire of love. Love is a fire. And we let it burn brightly as what we are. And as Rumi would say, and I burned and I burned and I burned. And so we smile to this dance that we are doing as we are ever more becoming the love that we seek, following the pathways of love and discovering the meaning and the purpose in this most amazing gift called life. With playfulness, with curiosity, with a deep fascination for this sense of belonging to the universe, we put our hands over our hearts, we open our eyes, and we say namaste, namaste. The divine presence in me bows to the divine presence in you. In this spaciousness, there is only one here, and we are that one. It's a new way of thinking in the world, isn't it? I was watching a video on Ram Dass last night. Well, I was taking my big Saturday night bath, and I have Ram Dass sitting over the tub, and I had the bubbles in the tub, and Ram Dass was talking about love. And what was so beautiful, it showed the young Ram Dass, who was a Harvard professor, who was brilliant and witty and clever. And then it showed the very, very old Ram Dass near the end of his life in a wheelchair after having had a stroke. And you could feel the evolution of the man who wrote Be Here Now to the old man who wrote Be Love Now. And near the end of Ram Dass's life, it was all transmission. It wasn't clever stories. There was just this old man sitting in a wheelchair. And one of the most profound moments was when he said, love your breath. Love your breath. Love your breath. And as I'm listening to this man, I'm moving into what is he really deeply saying. You know, when we incarnate with a breath. And when we leave this mortal coil, we exhale and we leave it with the breath. So what if breath, which is also another word for spirit, is what we are? And when he's saying, love your breath, he's saying, love the spirit that you are. It's more complicated than just a simple idea. When I studied with Thich Nhat Hanh, and I'm going to talk a little bit about him today, because this beautiful living saint, he's still alive, he talks about a reverence for the ancestors. And he says, the ancestors live in you. He says the expectation of the ancestors live in you. And he says, not only are there the physical ancestors, you've watched Finding Your Roots, how they all live within you, but he said your spiritual ancestors live within you. So Thich Nhat Hanh would say, the Buddha lives in me, right? And the expectations of the Buddha live in me. So then he talks about when Ram Dass was speaking to this Buddhist monk and they were dialoguing about what love is, the Buddhist monk said to Ram Dass, love is emptiness, Ram Dass. Ram Dass said, what? He said, love is emptiness. And Ram Dass looked quizzical. And then the Buddha said, you don't understand. Emptiness, the concept of emptiness means you're empty of the self. You're empty of the little self. Emerson says it's only the finite self that wails and suffers. That's me and my story and The finite self, you're empty of that. But he says the infinite presence lies stretched in smiling repose. So when there is no more finite self that's wailing and suffering and bemoaning of the past, Ram Dass said, you know, I get it. I get it. When you're empty, then all there is love, because there's no me that's separate from you. The only challenge we have is when we see ourselves as separate from other. There's a me and a you. You know, we objectify our world. We objectify relationships. When there is no object out there and it's all subjective, then, as my friend Terry says, then we realize that we're the sky. We're not the clouds. We're not the thoughts. And then what is the past? The past is merely a thought. Huh. And you can either follow that thought or you can observe that thought, but you don't have to get mired down in that thought. Now, someone asked me about when you cut yourself and having emotions, and why isn't it that a cut can heal like this? Because the universe knows what it's doing, but an emotional wound can last for years and years and years. Well, then, the beautiful thing is, see, the mind wants to find an answer, but the soul wants to find meaning. So what would the soul say about the emotional wound? It was on my Zen calendar yesterday, and I was talking about catching the threads, one of Llewellyn Von Lee's famous phrases. And so when I look at the Zen calendar, and there's a thread that goes in, and yesterday's thread was from Carl Jung. And Carl Jung said, we can only change the things that we accept. He said, if we argue against them, there's no hope for change, then they have you. So what if we accept that we have a country in turmoil, that we have a government that's on the verge of you know what, that we have contention within this country, that there is this faction? And when you accept that, I noticed that they tried to pass an Equality Act, and God knows if they'll gay LBGT thing, it'll pass in this country, because I've been on the other side of that for so many years. When I first moved to Alabama, there was an election going on, and they were running against the gay rights thing. And I remember everywhere in Alabama, I would see this bumper sticker that says, one man plus one woman equals a marriage. And, you know, as a young gay man, I thought, you know, here I'm stepping in Alabama. What are they going to do? My even prayer partner in Canada said, you know, he said, things don't look good for you, you gays in the States. And I said, oh, Terry, don't start. I said, we've come a long way. Yes, we've got further to go. But when you accept that that's part of it, there was a documentary recently that Trey and I watched, and it was about the evolution of the gay community. And I realized, oh my God, I lived through that. I lived through the time when we were illegal, when we were abominations, and how it took time, but we have evolved in consciousness. So what if we can accept that we're all a work in progress, even as a spiritual community? You know, what I love about this community is we don't have a religion. We really don't have a doctrine. We don't have concepts. We don't have God out here and hell down there and heaven up here. We don't have sin. Can you imagine? You're not going to burn in hell. It doesn't even exist. It's a state of consciousness. Is that too evolved of a spiritual path for most people? Probably. Can we enforce it and convert people? Not at all. You have to be ready to have a greater order of understanding. So one of my favorite things I say to parents is, I said, you have to be willing to let your children go. So many of the parents that we've been raised with, mine included, wanted to mold me into what they thought would be the appropriate child. Smart kid, do well in class, get a college degree, get a respectable career, all that sort of stuff. And then when you find you're going to college and you want to major in dance, well, that's not respectable. What kind of smart student would major in dance? And then I got out of that, and then finding this crazy religion. My mother, when she found out what this was, is she would never tell anybody in South Dakota what I did for a living, because she couldn't explain the religion to them. And she said, well, he's in this strange spiritual community that, are they Christian? Well, I don't know if he's Christian. I said, Mom, we're Christian and more. Why don't you say that? You know, but nothing I could say would make it palatable to those that want this conformity to an idea of what there is. So what if you, by being here, you're stepping out of the container? It was Rumi that says, let go of the shell and take hold of the pearl. So what does the shell represent to you? It represents an idea of what we're supposed to look like. And the world will give that to you until it's no longer adequate. I was sharing with the revealing service this morning, Trey and I watched Nomadland, which is up for all these awards with Frances McDormand. And it's a very troubling but beautiful story of a woman whose everything fell away in her life. Her husband dies and they were madly in love. His business folded in the little community. They were in the middle of nowhere in Nevada. I think he worked at a gypsum mine and the mine collapsed and everybody in the little town. So the town went belly up and she lost absolutely everything. She lost the shell. She lost the cage. And strangely, it set her soul free. She was dangerously free to live a life that she never thought she could live. And when the cage came around, and it did throughout this thing, where the well-meaning sister would say, move in with us, and we'll take care of you. We've got a big house. There's plenty of room here. And the little niece says, Aunt so-and-so, you're a homeless lady now. Mommy says you're a homeless person. She says, honey, I'm not a homeless person. I'm a person without a home. And there's a difference there. And she was living in her van, and she found this freedom that she had forgotten was what she really was. So the meaning from her soul was, I don't want to go back in a cage. I don't care whose cage it is. I have to honor, even at age 50-something, I'm going to step out in faith with this basic trust. Now, basic trust is something that it's so wonderful to cultivate. That's not trusting in the system, that trusting I'll be safe and trusting I'll have a job and trusting my unemployment. Okay. Basic trust says everything can fall to hell in a handbasket. And I still trust that this too is good, this too is for God, and I demand to see the blessing. To trust in the basic truth of life. We're having a pandemic here on the planet, but I trust that we at the Center for Spiritual Living safe distance and wear masks, and we're doing the appropriate thing. I trust that I'll get the shot when the time is right to get the shot. I trust that our country is going to work through its political issues in whatever way. Anne-Marie reminds me of that. We'll get through this. And maybe it'll evolve us into a greater order of being. That's my hope. And I live with this beautiful thing called hope. So I wanted to give you just a taste of Thich Nhat Hanh today because he's such an influence in my life. And he was the one that I saw in September of 2000. And that was a very meaningful month for me because my mother died very suddenly in the early months of September. She had a massive heart attack and she died. A week later, my teacher died of a brain tumor. And you talk about ancestors. He was like my spiritual father and she was my mother. And a week later, I'm sitting at the foot of Thich Nhat Hanh, this living saint, in Scutney, Vermont, in a tent on top of a mountain. It was a ski lodge that they converted in the fall. And this 900 people, and this was over the wall. I have arrived, I am home. And I remember sitting there in the front row, and the first thing that this man did was he moved his hand back and forth. He was sitting in the lotus position, and he said, all of life is a transmission. He said, there is a transmitter, there is a receiver, and there is that which is transmitted. And then he said, your parents do nothing less than transmit themselves to you. They live in you. And then he said, your teachers do nothing less than transmit themselves. They live in you. And in that holy instant, at the very beginning of this week-long silent meditation, I felt both my teacher Kennedy and my mother there. And when I'd walk out of that tent in silence, every flower was like them smiling at me. I thought I was going crazy. Am I going to be taunted by these people? And throughout that whole week, he spoke a teaching, and he says, you know, Buddhism at its very core is the science of mind. And that's what this teaching is, the science of mind, because it's an understanding of the nature of consciousness, you know, and how all of life is suffering. So he explained this Buddhist teaching in such an intimate sort of way. And in this little book, it's called Teachings on Love. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh would use very simple language that children could understand. I remember he had a whiteboard and he drew a big circle on the whiteboard. And then he put little dots with a black marker. And he says, those are seeds. And that circle represents your consciousness. And he says, you are the one that's a choice point. What seeds are you going to water? Are you going to water the seed of hatred? Are you going to water the seed of judgment? Are you going to water the seed of fear? Or are you going to water the seed of compassion? Are you going to water the seed of forgiveness? You know, we all have stories around our childhood and our parents, and it's very important to get to this place of forgiveness. You know, I forgive everyone. Jesus said, forgive 70 times 7. I forgive everyone. I forgive myself. I forgive all past experience. I forgive our parents. They did the best they could with what they had. You know, I forgive. And once you find that, that sets you free. It does nothing to them. It sets you free from this prison of self-righteous resentment. We no longer hold them in bondage by our story. And so his whole message is about learning to communicate in a loving way. He does a wonderful story in here about a husband and wife, where the husband goes to the wife and says, I am suffering. Can I share my seeds of suffering so that you can embrace me? So it's a whole different way of relating to one another. And it's so interesting. He talks about teachings on love. This whole book's on love. And he doesn't use it in the way that we've been talking about it all month. He said, in fact, in Buddhism, they don't like to use the word love because people so flippantly use it. Like, I love hamburgers, or I love French fries. Trey and I like to watch House Hunters International, and people will come into a place and say, oh, I hate that, I hate that. I said, how can somebody hate a countertop or hate the cupboards that are not white because they're brown? And I said, awfully strong emotion for a countertop. I hate that countertop. So what if we could be impeccable with our word and kind of exercise the word hate and even love and see a different way of approaching it? So he talks about the four immeasurable aspects of mind, the four immeasurable minds that we have. Now, remember, we suffer when we're in the local mind. So much of what we're doing in meditation and in prayer is to move out of the local mind into the non-local mind, that mind that we all share. And then to allow, when we're empty of me, then this love that we all share can flow through it. So what if we are the pathway for love to flow when there's no me there? There's just this beautiful presence. Then that universal presence will love a baby squirrel, will love the little worms that cross on the pathway. When I was doing the walking meditation with Thich Nhat Hanh, it was after a rainy day like we had the other day, and the worms were all over the walkway. And here we're following this little monk as we're taking one step, and Thich Nhat Hanh said, you know, the miracle is not to walk on water like Jesus was reputed to do. The miracle is not to walk on fire. We have all this fire walking going on now. But he says, the miracle is to walk on this earth where every step is a recognition of the sacredness, that right where you step is holy ground. And so as he's giving us this message about the miracle of walking on earth with a sense of reverence, I'm seeing all the worms that are crossing the pathway. And as I'm lifting one foot and then the next foot in this walking meditation, I'm stepping over the worms and I'm feeling like they're my brothers and my sisters, hoping that everybody else does too. But by the very nature of being fully conscious, nobody was squishing the worms. The worms were okay. So here he talks about the four immeasurable minds that are the basis of what they would call love. And listen to the difference and see if you can go deeper into our true nature as love. And he says the first one is a thing called Maitri. And this would be called loving kindness that recognizes that we're all in this together. He says we're interbeing, we're interconnectedness. Thich Nhat Hanh would say, when you look at the paper on the page, I don't see the paper. He said, I see the tree that made the paper. I see the earth out of which the tree grew. I see the sun that created the photosynthesis and the rain. So he said, what if it's all connected? Now, this is how a mystic sees things, how we're not separate individuals, but we're all drops of water in the ocean of love. That means that we're fully love as a drop, but yet we're really the ocean. So here's Thich Nhat Hanh. Without understanding, your love is not true love. This beautiful saying, with all you're getting, get understanding. So he says, without understanding, your love is not true love. You must look deeply in order to see and understand the needs, aspirations, and sufferings of the one you love. Could we be attentive to the one that we love and their suffering? You know, I am very good with my animals. I can feel it. I wish I could be better with some humans. You know, to really tune into their suffering and then invite them to look at the source and say, what is the core of that suffering? And when that stuff comes up, could we be willing to dialogue with our own suffering self? You know, that's the great noble truth. The first one is all life is suffering. And when you look at the nature of suffering, then you have a way of letting go of that suffering. So what is the tormenting idea that's creating suffering in me? Could I be willing to let go of that thought? Or at least respond to it in a different way. So he says that's the understanding that's required. We all need love. Love brings us joy and well-being. And it is as natural as the air that we breathe. He says we are loved by the air. Wow. Feel into that one. We're loved by the air. And he says, and we're loved by the trees. I love hearing this kind of stuff. He says we need trees to be healthy. And in order to be loved, we have to love, which means we have to understand. And for our love to continue, we have to take the appropriate action or non-action to protect the air, to protect the trees, to protect our beloved. He's saying we're all interconnected. So this is the Maya tree. It's all about loving kindness. May I be filled with loving kindness for worms, for trees, for little squirrels that fall out of trees. May I be well, may I be peaceful and at ease. This is a loving kindness meditation. So that's the first form of love, which is this compassion, kindness place. He says, this is the love of friendship. Now, you know, in the Greeks, they had three forms of love. There was the eros love, which is the physical love. Then there's the philos love, which would be this, that were the brotherly love. Al and I, he's my spiritual brother, And then there's the agape love, which is the spiritual love. This is something that we all share in common. And so could we play in this realm of love and know its multidimensionality? It's so much bigger than what we thought it was. Then we no longer objectify love into the special love. Yes, we'll have special loves, our husband and our little girl, but it all has a sense of equanimity after a while. That's the fourth aspect of this. So the first one is Maya tree, which is this loving kindness. The second aspect of love he talks about is a word called karuna. And he says the second aspect of true love is karuna. The intention and capacity. Now, I love that word capacity. Buddha says you don't learn from experience. You learn from your capacity to experience. So he was saying we learn about love from our capacity to love as well. So the second aspect of true love is karuna, the intention and capacity to relieve and transform suffering and to lighten sorrows. To relieve the suffering, and to lighten our sorrows. Now, he says this is the path of compassion, where deep looking and deep listening arises. Could I look at the suffering on the planet, like those people did in Texas when they saw the turtles were suffering? And could I deeply listen to where that suffering is coming from and hear them? It's hearing the cries of the world. Hearing the cries of the world. One of my trees, Adam was over the other day, and I noticed all the sap was falling from the trees. And I remember when he trimmed a branch, there were bugs around the trees. And I know that the tree now is suffering. She's infected with some kind of bugs under her bark. So I'm hearing the cry of that tree, and I'm seeking ways to spray or probably get Adam over there with the ladder, and we'll spray the tree and try to save the tree, because I'm hearing her cries. That's compassion. Compassion, he says, to develop this compassion in ourselves, we need to practice mindful breathing, love your breath, deep listening, and deep looking. Mindful breathing. He reminded me, one of my dear friends, Cindy Swearingen, she was a yoga teacher that was one of my best friends, and she was a ministerial student. And her gospel, the gospel of Cindy Swearingen, is one word, breathe. She said, do you know how sacred the breath is? The breath is breathing you. Thich Nhat Hanh, when he taught meditation, he says, breathing in, I breathe in. Breathing out, I breathe out. He says, in, out. And he says, all you need is to follow the breath. How simple is that? So in this compassionate path, it's about learning to mindfully breathe. You know, sometimes when people get upset, they hold their breath. So the first thing you can say to them is exhale. And in that simple exhalation, there is a sense of release, a sense of letting go. And then deeply look within. And sometimes we're going to find the inner bitch or the inner critic. And listen to the inner critic. Listen to the inner bitch. They're trying to get our attention for some reason. And when we no longer deny it or try to get rid of it, which is an act of violence, and we can actually listen to it and say, what do you need from me? Then oftentimes we'll find that they need to be validated and heard just like everybody else. There's something in us that's crying out. Could we listen to that and say, what do you need, my little one? We do it with our pets. We do it with our children. Could we have enough compassion to do it for ourselves? So this is the path of compassion, he said. Compassion contains a deep concern. You know the other person is suffering, and you sit close to her, and you look and listen deeply to her, and then you're able to touch her pain. You remember my grandmother, she had this wonderful transmission when I was a little boy and I would cry. My father would scream at me, you want something to cry? I'll give you something to cry for. But she was much more compassionate, and she'd take me on her lap, and she'd hold me, she had these big breasts, and she'd cradle me in her breasts and rock me back and forth, and she'd kiss the boo-boo and make it better. And you know what? She did. And I felt so much better. So what if something as simple as compassion from a loving presence is enough? Jean Houston, one of my teachers, and she was raised by a mother who was Italian and very dramatic, histrionic, you might say. And her husband, her father, was a comedy writer for Bob Hope in Hollywood. So he was just Mr. Funny Bones. And she said being raised in this turbulent family was not easy as a child. So she said, I was raised by the dogs. And you talk about transmission. She wrote a book called The Darshan that she would get with the dogs. They would just look and they'd transmit their peace. Jean Ann is going to the pound. She calls it dog medicine. She goes to the cages, she cleans up the poop, and she's getting darshan from the dogs. You know, they do. They transmit that love. They don't know anything else to do. They don't have a whole lot of thoughts going on, but they have a lot of this something going on. Could you open to that? That's compassion. So that was the second way. The third aspect of this divine love, what he calls the, what did he call it? Some kind of mind, the immeasurable mind. You can't measure it. And the third aspect is called mudita, which we would call joy. The third element of true love is mudita, or joy. Dwelling happily in the present moment, when you're in this natural joy, it's not happiness where I'm happy when you do what I think you should do. That's not happiness. Joy is something that's always there. Serena is a joyful person, aren't you, Serena? She lives in joy. So he says, dwelling happily in the present moment, then we don't rush into the future. We know that everything is here in the present moment. I don't have to say I'll be happy when I get to, you name the place, El Paso. No, I carry this joy within me wherever I am. You know, I think it says in the Psalms, I've been in the pits of hell and lo, thou art there. I've been in the fields of heaven and lo, thou art there. Could I find that joy even in those moments, you know, when things are kind of hairy in life? You know, this year, this month, we just had the year anniversary of Humphrey's herniated disc, where he literally couldn't move from the neck down. And I'm so grateful now he's actually running a little bit. He could go up the steps. It's like he's found a second new leash on life. He has his one eye. Sometimes he collapses on my lap, and I say, he's got his little one eye down there, and he's snorting, and but he can walk again. And it's just like there's so much joy in just being there with him. He says, dwelling happily in the present moment, we don't rush out to the next moment. And he says, this is dwelling in mindfulness. And then we can touch those wondrous and refreshing things that are always there. We can see God in the smallest of things, and our mind of joy will arise naturally. And he says, a deeper definition of mudita is that there is a joy that is filled with peace and contentment amidst whatever life is bringing us. That's that basic trust that you cultivate. No matter what is happening, we got this pandemic and all kinds of stuff going on in the world, there is a joy that can meet all of that. And that's that mudita. Takes love to a much bigger place, doesn't it, than just this romantic idea. And then the last is my favorite. The last is the word upeksha. And upeksha comes from the root word upa, which means over, and iksh, which means to look. And he says, imagine that you're on top of a mountain and you're looking out over creation. You have this detached awareness. And so what this word means in English would be equanimity. You begin to see that it's all the same, that there aren't precious religions and bad religions. There aren't good people and bad people, you know, righteous people and sinful people. There is an equanimity. There isn't a higher order of species, the human being. He's made superior to all the others and take dominion over the... I think the octopus is superior to the humans. Adam and I were talking about this. Well, is that heretical? Probably, but I'll say it anyway. So he goes on to say, upeksha. If your love has attachment, discrimination, prejudice, or clinging in it, it is not love. The Sadhguru that I studied with, he said that what you most people think of love is really attachment. And he said attachment isn't love. Attachment is what M. Scott Peck calls cathecting. And it's okay to be attached. I'm attached to all y'all. I'm attached to the garden. I'm attached, but I'm not attached to the outcome. And so people will come in and they'll go out of my life. And it's like, you know, when I say we have to learn to let our children go, our children are like a butterfly. They land on our hand and we don't say, that's my kid and I'm going to mold it. We let that butterfly land and then we let that butterfly go. And so what if we could have a relationship with all of life like that? Something comes in, Bubba Jake will be in my life today, but he might be out climbing a mountain tomorrow. But I'll know that the love that's still there. So then you don't sit there and attach and control and manipulate and have expectations, but rather you allow it to be what it is. You're dangerously free in your freedom of loving. So this is equanimity. Equanimity, he says, the wisdom of equality, the ability to see everyone as equal, not discriminating between ourselves and others. Everybody as equal. There's no hierarchy. There's no more evolved. We're all the same in this ocean of love. Wow, then there's nowhere to get, is there? Because you're already there. I was sharing with them, my prayer partner is in Victoria, British Columbia, where he was born. And he was abused as a child, so he never wanted to go back there because he had all those bad memories. And he said, I found myself sitting on a beach just the other day, and he was so excited to tell me. He's 73 years old. And he said, I'm looking out at the ocean, and I hear this little voice in my head. We were talking about the voices in our head. And he said, it was my own little kid. And he said, you finally come home. And he says, and I looked around, and the corner sign, he said it was the very street on which he was born. He saw the sign up there, looking back from the ocean. And he said, David, he said, I'm coming home to myself. And I said, isn't that beautiful? You're finally coming home to yourself. You've run away all these years, now at 73. And it's not just Victoria, the city. It's he's coming home to that little part of him that had been repressed and exiled, who was now coming up to be acknowledged. He never went anywhere. So this equanimity is this the wisdom of equality, the ability to see everything as equal. Without upeksha, he says, your love may become possessive. Anybody ever been in a possessive relationship? I've been in the past, and it doesn't work out, trust me. Because you find that it's not about them, it's about your attachment to them that you're experiencing. And then you realize that you don't experience life as it is, you experience life as you are. So when I let go of the possessor, the one who thinks he's possessing, well, then I can have a free relationship with Al. I don't have to possess Al. He doesn't belong to me. He belongs to the universe. You know, I've seen so many people in marriages, and the marriage ends, and it sets them free. When your marriage ended, I think you went to South America on a boat, and you were traveling all over the world. And I was so impressed with this man's freedom, dangerously free, I asked him to give a talk to the class. Because literally, he had stepped out of a container that was a beautiful container, a custom-designed container. But the freedom was so delicious to see. And ever since I've known him, he's become freer and freer. He swims all over the world now. He scuba dives, and now he's found a refuge in the Chattanooga Aquarium where he cleans the tank out. See, he's in service. He says, without upeksha, your love will become possessive. A summer breeze can be very refreshing, but if we try to put it in a tin can so that we can have it entirely for ourselves, he says, then the breeze will die. Ha ha ha. Our beloved is the same. He is like a cloud, a breeze, a flower, and if you imprison him in a tin can, he will die. So, yet many people try to do this. They rob their loved one of their liberty until they can no longer be themselves. They live to satisfy themselves and to use their loved one to help them fulfill their version of what their life should look like. And he says, that is not loving, but that is destroying. So he says, you say you love him, but if you do not understand his aspirations, his needs, his difficulties, well, then he's in the prison of your own idea of love. Wow. True love always allows you to preserve your freedom and the freedom of your beloved. This is upeksha. And then he concludes with these four things. For love to be true love, it must contain compassion, joy, equanimity, and loving kindness. Those qualities. Huh. And he says, this is what we call the four immeasurable aspects of mind. Now, he uses the big M, mind. The four immeasurable, because you can't measure them, aspects of mind. Now, we've got to take the idea that the mind is somewhere up here in the brain. It isn't. The mind is something that we all access. Terry was referencing the sky of mind, the awake awareness that precedes all thought. So what if what we are in this immeasurable loving presence is that which has no thought, and yet thought may arise within it. And so when thoughts arise, are we going to follow them? Are we going to believe them? Or are we going to say, oh, there's a thought of this, there's a thought of that. Very creative, yes. But we can choose where we want to go during that path. So to find meaning in the little things on the teachings of love. I used this book throughout this whole month. It was called Love, the Ultimate Answer to the Meaning of Life. And there's like 100 different little essays in here, and they're all so profound. From Albert Einstein saying what we are is to harness that great power of love that we all share and let it ripple out into the world. I was asking, how would I give birth to God? And I found myself writing, I would say to God, use me, let me be an instrument for your peace, for your love, for your grace, for truth. Then the second one is to cultivate that basic trust that wherever I am, whatever's going on, I can trust in this divine presence to assist me in assuming the consciousness that's required in order to make the next step, even when those voices come up from within. Then the third one is to love one another and know that it's all me, and to really experience that love, not a possessive love, but a love that liberates. The fourth one is to set the mind free, the little mind that has all its demands and needs, to set it free, let it out of the cage of me. It doesn't need to hang out in there anymore. Then who would I be without those thoughts? Who would you be, Terry, without those thoughts? You'd be dangerously free, wouldn't you? You'd just be one big old smile, one big emptiness. And then the last one is to keep that flame of the soul tended within our being so that it can burn at whatever age we are. Ram Dass said, when I was very young, that flame of love burned so brightly that all that was left of me was ash. He says, now at the old age, I'm sitting around tending the embers within the cave of my soul, letting that fire still be kindled within me. So I went to the very end of the book, I love doing that, to a yogini. She teaches the Ashtanga Yoga. And I love the way she talks about the meaning of life in her very mystical sort of way. And she says, the meaning of life goes beyond any language. If someone tries to give you the meaning, she says, don't listen to them. But she put it in a context in which I think we can all hear at a deeper level. Remember, it's not about content. Content comes and goes, like thoughts. But context is like the sky of mind, which is always there. So could we have the context of this divine presence, this divine love, as our true nature, and then out of that context, everything else arises? The 10,000 things, as they say in Taoism. So here's this beautiful woman, a yogini, who talks about life's mystery. She said, it reveals itself as we seek its meaning. Adam is finding so much expansion within him because it's revealing itself. It's flowering within our being. And it's giving us meaning. He says, this is how she puts it. We are the artist in our own self-portrait, while at the same time, we are humbled by a higher force pre-embedded within the design. There is a divine template within all of us. Yes, we create this image of who we think we are, but there's something that's so much bigger. And that's what she's trying to point us toward. My friend Terry, she talked about being tethered at the center. So she's referencing the same thing. We're humbled by this higher force that's pre-embedded within the design. And in our search, she says, continuous and omniscient, means all-knowing, the search which never ends, we have experiences along the way that return us to the pulse of the present moment, to the breathing quality that is all of life. All of life is breathing. We had a engineer once here at the center, and he was working with environmental sciences. And he said to me, David, you know, they've taken photographs of our planet, and they actually show that our planet is breathing. This planet is a breathing planet. So what if this is all the breath of God? It's all the spirit of God. He's saying the same thing. She said, it goes back to the breath. Ram Dass, love the breath. Breath meaning spirit. So he's saying it goes back to this breath. We have to experience the return to this pulse of the present moment, to the breathing quality that is all of life. And in this unifying realization that we are the same and one, infinite and limitless, a tender then sweetness begins to shine forth from within us. A tender sweetness comes from within us. My God, we are this vast, infinite something, and something in us knows that. That's that infinite presence that lies stretched in smiling repose. Yes, my darling, you're it. Tag, you're it. Wake up. It's time. Yeah. A tender sweetness shines forth from within, and we connect with our heart, feeling the presence of God everywhere. We connect with our heart and we feel the presence of God everywhere. Is it that simple? Yeah, it's that simple. Connect with our heart and we feel the presence of God everywhere. That's the meaning. The last little part she says, the quest to find the answer starts at a source within us. Jesus called it the kingdom of heaven that lies within. Seek it first and everything is added unto you. As we dive deeper into ourselves, we begin to experience an interconnectedness to all around us, to other people, to animals, to nature, and ultimately to the cosmos. I find myself staring at the sky a lot. We had a full moon the other night. After seeing these shots of Mars, we're made out of stardust. Think about that. And you're also made out of Earth. So could we know ourselves as all of that, and yet even the Earth? He says, a magical unfolding then automatically happens from tapping into our divine energy that lives in us to that which exists everywhere around us, and it is eternal. We're not temporal beings, we're eternal beings. So time collapses and eternity awakens. And then you realize that you're an eternal soul that's probably had incarnation after incarnation. Maybe you've lived a life as a squirrel, or a life as an octopus, or a life as a tree. And you're all of that and none of that. That's this awakening that she says happens. You're everywhere, you're eternal. And from experience, life's interwoven nature, that's that inner beingness, we show our appreciation for the gift of this life that we've all been given through service, compassion, and gratitude. So in her simplicity as an Ashtanga yoga teacher, she would say maybe the meaning is to be in service to the one, service to the love, in service to each other, in service to the planet, in service to the air, in service to the trees, in service, in compassion, to hear the cries of the world, to open your heart, to know that they're all your children. And then she says, and gratitude. To live with this grateful heart. Oh my God, I'm still here. After the heart attack, the one feeling that was so strong was, oh my God, I'm still here. I'm still in this life form. I still have time to do more loving and to tell everybody that I love them, that you're all part of me. What a blessing. I didn't go like my mother did all of a sudden on a Tuesday. I came back on a Monday and here I am. So, and I know Adam feels the same way too. He got very close. Her last little saying is this, the vastness of life's essence and the glimpses that we are able to grasp extends way beyond any language. To glimpse the divine in the smallest of things is better than seeing an angel. To look in the face of someone that you love and to see the twinkle looking back, and it's the same twinkle that's looking back at me. To glimpse the divine. And then he says, it is in the simplicity of coming home to our body, coming home to our breath, tuning into the original silence that's within us, that still small voice. That's why it's so profound to say, just be still. Terry, when your mind's going, just say, be still. And it'll just shut up because you're not putting attention on it. And then the stillness becomes home. So coming home to our body, to our breath, tuning into the original silence, the stillness within, then we can begin to evoke an understanding on what the meaning of life is. You got to go home first, as my friend Terry Hart would say. Go home to the core of your being, and it will tell you what the meaning of life is, but we have to find it for ourselves and to listen to it. So let's just go home for just a second to a home that's already there. Oh, by the way, I forgot to say this. The class is starting on March 9th and 10th, Living Beautifully with Uncertainty and Change. This is the book. You can get it at Amazon. There's a sign-up sheet out there, or you can let Jody Rutenberg know on Facebook. And we're having a night class on Tuesday and a day class on Wednesday. I'd love for you to take it. It's really relevant for these times. Huh. And having said that, living beautifully. All happens when we live from our center and not from the circumference of life. When we're at the circumference, we're going up and down, round and round. But we're in the center, we're at that still point. And so as my beloved Terry says, we can tether ourselves to that center point. We can just rest there. I like rest better than tether. Rest. Rest in that center. And know that every time we return to center, we are coming home. Home is a place that we never left. We're coming home to present moment awareness. We're coming home to the breath that's breathing us. We're coming home to a peace that no external can give us, but a peace that is already established. The Bible calls it a peace that passes all understanding. You don't have to understand it. It's right there in the midst of chaos and confusion and all kinds of emotional upheaval. That peace is just sitting there, smiling, waiting. And so we're coming home to peace right now. I invite you to come home to emptiness. Being empty of the self, the little self.
You know, I think of the little self as that part of me that goes, well, you know, you're always making fun of my little self. And
No. We're not making fun of you. We're just coming home to a place beyond where you're running the show. And then you can be a wonderful assistant.
Well, thanks. I'll be your assistant.
Good. So we'll have a relationship. And so resting as this expansive divine love, as this presence of oneness, we come home to the gratitude for the grace of this life. What a blessed life we've been given. Gratitude for the friends that we have in our community. Gratitude for our belief system that is ever evolving and growing, not out of concepts, but out of context. A belief system that's based on spaciousness, not on conclusions. And so we come home to the I don't know place, but there's something within that does know. And so we defer to that. We say, okay, Spirit, I don't know, but you do. And so I'm coming home to you. I invite you to come home to that smile, the smile that the Buddha has on his face, that smile that knows all is well all the time, that infinite presence that lies stretched in smiling repose at the center of your being. Come home to that. And notice that you're coming home to the truth of your being. It was Carl Jung that said, the unexamined life isn't worth living. And so by our willingness to examine the life that we've been given, we are discovering that there's so much more to us than what we thought we were. We are not just a skin-encapsulated ego with a bunch of thoughts, but we are a spacious emptiness out of which everything arises. And we are the breath that is breathing all of that. We share the same breath. We don't put that breath in a can and call it my breath. But rather we draw from that breath, the breath of life, and we are that breath of life, awakening in time and space. And so we abide attentively in present moment awareness, and we say, I have arrived, I am home. I have arrived in this holy instant to a place within that is home, honoring the moment, the sacred moment, that is everywhere, unfolding herself as itself, in us and all around us. We are that. So smile, be there. It's that simple. And then let your song sing, your soul sing your song. Dangerously free to sing your song. Universe, the one song. Being sung by the many, from the one to the one. And you are that, and so am I. So place your hands in prayer fashion now over your heart, and let's join in the heart salutation by saying, I honor you.
I respect you.
I love you.
You are the deepest aspect of the self.
The beloved in me bows to the beloved in you.
In this spaciousness we are one.
And all is well. Opening to that, letting your beautiful vibration of love radiate out into the world, and know that you're not the doer, but that this love is doing you. And then just feel into that. Thanks for sending in your tithes.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org. To create a brand new world.